All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. We appreciate you joining us today. I'm Corey Worden. I'm the current administrator for the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialty, and you're listening to the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialty's HealthBeat podcast. So today we've got a great episode. Today we're talking to Tracy Davies Fletcher, who is the chief nurse over at the Houston Health Department. And over there within her role, she is also over the employee health team. So they do all kinds of great correlation and collaboration with overall safety and incident prevention, including respiratory protection programs and medical surveillance and vaccinations and all kinds of great stuff. So Tracy's going to be talking to us today about a lot of the different work they've done with things like overall disease exposure prevention, not only with COVID-19, but also with influenza and in the past with things like Ebola and other diseases. And she'll be talking with us about her other experiences with things like hazmat response and overall emergency management. So we're looking forward to her perspectives and experiences, and we're going to go ahead and get right into it. Thank you all for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Corey. And I am the nursing chief here at the Houston Health Department, which employs about 1,300 to 1,500 individuals. We provide health and human services ranging from family planning, dental immunizations, environmental vital statistics, emergency preparedness. We do asthma prevention, some diabetes education, family planning, TB care, and sexual health services. So I work in partnership with the bureau chiefs and division managers and all of those programs to make sure that nursing services is involved in those areas and that we are providing the optimal services for all of the clients that receive each of those entities. I have been a nurse for over 15 years, originally trained in critical care. I've also participated as a CPR instructor, a hazmat and disaster response certified instructor. And around 2014, I jumped with both feet first into public health, and I haven't looked back.
That's excellent. Yeah, definitely great experiences. And I know that you didn't mention this yourself, but I know that you've also done outstanding amount of work with the COVID-19 response here in Houston. And I know that to your point a minute ago, I know that you have the team with the Houston Health Department, but you also did an enormous amount of things like infection prevention, exposure prevention training, and fit testing, and all kinds of things with partnering health systems for the pandemic as well. So that's great.
When COVID-19 first showed up in Houston, we and you were on that group too, when we were kind of monitoring the numbers and looking at it from afar, and then it showed up in the United States, and then it showed up in Texas, and then it showed up in Houston, and we had a plan in action. We began to implement the testing and infection control. So we set up our testing sites on the north and south sides of town, and as testing expanded to then the vaccination response. And of course, we did a lot of contact tracing in between then. And now we're just looking at moving forward to what I see on the horizon as treatment. And so I'm really, really excited about the work that we've done with COVID-19 and how many partnerships we've developed around the city. And how nursing services has really been, and safety has been a great part of that initiative.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So kind of speaking of that, I mean, of course, there's definitely the pandemic. That's been on everybody's mind for the last, goodness, what, 21 months almost. Of course, everything that comes with that, airborne transmitted diseases and body fluids and droplets and all that. But in addition to all that, so over the years, like you said, you've worked in critical care and all different kinds of roles. What types of hazards have you seen the most in your career?
Well, these days, like you mentioned, you kind of look at life pre-COVID and post-COVID. So pre-COVID, I've dealt with some things that were a little routine in the ICU, which were the nosocomial infections. We did have, working with the infectious disease doctors, some things that were a little similar to a few episodes of House, where we had some individuals come in with some pretty gnarly infections, and we had to figure out what happened, because in ICU, a lot of our patients were incapacitated, so they couldn't tell their story. So we had to figure it out. And I remember we once had this patient who was on a ventilator, extremely septic. We had tried some of the strongest antibiotics on this particular patient. And we found that he was a farmer and had been exposed to well water that was contaminated. And it was such a huge discovery after we found out, you know, what actually happened. And we were able to treat him, and he ended up being the success story. But just seeing him, he came in, we actually had him on hypothermia. He ended up on a balloon pump for a while. So that was one of those things like, wow, you really see the impact of an infection on someone and how it can really just tear a person who's relatively healthy, tear their body down so much. And then on the public health side, one of the things that I went through in my initial role as a nursing chief is I had a patient that I came in that took her laundry off the line and went to take it out of the basket, and she was bitten by a bat that was rabid. So that was my first time actually going through the rabies vaccine procurement process and administration process, doing the education. So my learning curve was very, very quick, but we made it happen. And she actually was, it was a successful case. She ended up being asymptomatic fairly quickly, a week or so after she began her treatment regimen. So that was a success story. And then more recently, with the Hurricane Harvey shelter that presented a unique infection control challenge with a mixed demographic of residents with varying health statuses and limited resources. However, with the collaboration of the health department, SETRAC, American Red Cross, FEMA, we were able to manage disease containment, triage the acutely ill, and adhere to effective standards of care protocols to embrace the best practices.
Definitely. Yeah, that's fantastic. Fantastic work. You know, I like how you bring that up as well, as far as the shelter during Hurricane Harvey. You know, that's a, in case anybody's not familiar with Hurricane Harvey, is an enormous catastrophic flooding event here in Houston, Texas in 2017. But yeah, a lot of times those types of things don't get discussed outside of either emergency management or public health is the shelter operations. There's a number of infection prevention situations with that. And I'm glad you mentioned that. That's important. And, you know, it's also of interest, speaking of the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, that when the situation first began, you know, as you know, for those that don't know, of course, when a lot of people know the situation that started in March, you know, with the mass testing. And but before that, you know, when the cases were still in the single digits and it was an emerging threat or an emerging hazard, epidemiologists would go to do patient visits in their homes. And so that was really a very early stage evolution as far as medical surveillance and validation that the PPE and respiratory protection work, and a lot of different things there that a lot of times don't get discussed these days, because it's just the pandemic has become such a large in scale. But y'all definitely did a fantastic job with all of that.
Yes, it was quite an experience to be there, but it was one of those things when you see so many people pulling together with the common goal and you see the actual product of your hard work, you see it happening in real time, and it was just amazing to be a part of, and then to see so many individuals coming from all across the United States coming in to help us. So that was amazing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. And the partnerships are always great. A lot of combined subject matter expertise and experience, definitely. So with that being said, you know, speaking of subject matter expertise and experiences, you know, like you said, you've dealt with, you know, a lot of infection prevention issues. You've dealt with critical care, ICU, pandemic level viruses. What types of safety protocols or safety programs have you seen over your career that have been especially effective?
I think that in my experience, the most effective safety protocols are those that include proactive planning. And that proactive planning has to be with engaged stakeholders. They focus on prevention, not reaction. And all of those safety protocols have a built-in quality assurance mechanism. Safety can't just be a practice. It has to be a part of the culture of an organization. And it should be interwoven into all of the policies and procedures of an organization, not just an afterthought.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's great. Great perspective. I totally agree. You know, being able to continually assess the different hazards and keep updating the protocols, and then from there, you know, communicate the expectations and validate that they're being done properly, and then following up on any potential fallout. There's definitely continual improvement and getting all the input and all the expertise. Yeah, that's fantastic. So in that same regard, kind of the flip side of that coin, what kind of challenges have you seen over the years? I know you mentioned, you know, mysterious unknown causal factors of diseases and whatnot, or medical conditions, I should say. But any other big challenges you've seen across the field?
I think in general, the biggest challenge in healthcare is when we focus on the quote unquote best intentions. We want to see as many patients as quickly as possible, as many as possible. However, productivity, utilization rate, success must factor in time for safety, or we're putting our workers and our patients at risk. So the biggest factor is our self-imposed factors that we're putting in safety.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That's also great input. You know, it's interesting. That's a conversation we used to have a lot when I was in acute care. And speaking of, like you said, like you said, and whatnot, is we always had that conversation around patient handling. You know, patient mobility, is that there was always this, you know, like you said, there's the kind of ever-present concern to, you know, to see more patients and to, you know, push. But the reality is that, you know, if those things lead people to bypass safe patient handling or the different controls that are needed to make sure that there's not injuries or exposures or whatnot, then like you said, it's, you know, it becomes counterproductive. I know with ICU, you of course have a very unique situation there, but have you ever seen issues with patient handling over the years?
Absolutely. I think in specifically in ICU, taking the time to utilize some of the safety resources would be one of the unique challenges for an ICU nurse, because we had a lift, or we had these assistive devices that were resources available to us. But we would just grab another partner and say, hey, let me turn this patient with me. And then we had the highest amount of back injuries. And we were like, why is everyone hurting their backs? when we have all of these beds that rotate and you have all of these things that you can use. And then when you get down to it and you start doing the assessment saying, have you used this? Did you use that? Or you're looking at the lift that you have and it has dust on it. And you're like, you guys aren't using what we have to keep you safe. So then it goes into finding out the why. So you have to take it a step further to find out why we're not prioritizing safety.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I like how you're able to explain that within your experiences. You know, patient handling is always a critical issue. And we actually had that conversation, speaking of shelters, we had that conversation as well just a little bit ago to make sure that, you know, if a shelter is expected to take in clients that require mobility assistance, you know, then that becomes a hazard to look at as potential either patient falls or of course strains and things of that nature. So definitely, you know, I was also going to ask you, were you involved in 2014 in the Ebola preparation?
Yes, I was involved in that actually with Memorial Hermann. I was still with Memorial Hermann then. So some of the, I guess, more global infection protocols that I went through with Memorial Hermann included the Ebola preparation, the H1N1 SARS outbreak. That's kind of what we prepared for when I was a nurse there. And then coming over to the city, I've dealt with more so COVID and then our shelter response here. And we had a measles outbreak where we actually went into Harris County Jail and vaccinated many of the inmates at that time when we had a measles and mumps outbreak in the jail. And so those are some of the things that I've dealt with on this side of the world in public health.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Yeah, it's interesting. That's also a unique situation. I can attest to that also is one of those things about, you know, working in the public health area that a lot of times doesn't get discussed regularly is, you know, things like doing responses to situations in the jail or whatnot. You know, we did all the COVID-19 testing over in the juvenile centers, and then we've done assessments and a lot of work with epidemiology for the jails and whatnot. So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's it doesn't get talked about much, but there's a lot of intrinsic rewards to doing that, you know, because it's very much a direct means to help people. Definitely people that don't get talked about that much.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's a call that's placed upon public health entities to actually take care of that particular population, because that's an underserved population. So we're responsible to making sure that that particular population is protected. They deserve care. They deserve health care. They deserve vaccines for vaccine preventable diseases, as well as the individuals that take care of the inmates that are there, because they can take these diseases home to their families. And so it's really a public health call for us to take care of that population.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I know there's also been, you know, a great amount of work with doing the COVID-19 services at the homeless population shelters and a lot of different areas like that. So that's very very noble work. You know, y'all do a fantastic job.
Thank you.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, the thing that came to mind about the Ebola, I was thinking as you were if you were discussing about the need for being able to assess a situation and then take a step back and find the proper safety protocols, is I remember when we were dealing with that in the same time frame, same area, is that the week before Ebola literally, you know, arrived here in Texas in was it September of 2014, we were having some, I don't want to say difficulties, but we were having some of those situations where you know, there'll be some potential exposures to tuberculosis or meningitis. And, you know, we would talk about it and people would say, well, you know, I don't have time for all those protocols. You know, we're trying to take care of these people and it's just not, you know, it's not happening that way. And we were trying, like, we got to find common ground here because we can't just open up the doors for these exposures, you know? And when the calls started coming in about Ebola, which was in Dallas, just, you know, 4 hours north, the vibe changed immediately, where everybody was all about stop and follow the protocols to the exact detail, you know. And not only that, but have somebody there to observe and monitor and bleach everything. You know, it was absolutely high reliability. So it was interesting to see that shift with the emergence of Ebola in the United States.
Yes, I remember that's when I received my hazmat certification at Memorial Hermann during the Ebola time. And working night shift, of course, most of the trainings were offered during the daytime. And so they said, we need somebody to do hazmat training. So, of course, you know, I was a clinical coordinator, so I had to do it, essentially. And I had one other person who was an adrenaline junkie. He's like, I'm going to do it. And so it's like, what's the chance of this happening here? And so the two of us, you know, we go through the training. And then sure enough, that's when we had this exposure at the stadium at a high school football game, where all of a sudden kids came in with this symptom, where all of a sudden, randomly, they just became really, really incoherent. And they were having syncopal episodes. And some of them actually stopped breathing. And they were bringing them in. They were like, it happened at, you know, 9 o'clock at night. It's night shift on. All of the day shift nurses who really went to the training were all gone home. So who's on to do the hazmat setup? It's me, because that other guy who was in the class with me was gone on vacation. They were like, so how are we supposed to set this tent up, Tracy? I was like, am I the only one who's trained to do this? And it was so funny. And I was like, okay, well, let's do it. And so we went and we started setting things up, and, you know, we went through with the hot zone, and like it was a real just in time training for how to do hazmat control, how to put on the suit, how to do all of these things. And it was the most amazing adrenaline feel, everything that you can think of, every adjective in the world, which ended up, you know, being some kind of gas leak at the stadium was what happened and why the kids were having the symptoms that they were having. But at the end of the day, it was like, wow. And then everyone realized, okay, we need to get serious about this. We need to get more people trained on this. We can't just rely on one person to know what to do if this were to occur. But it was, you know, for lack of a better term, exciting to experience. And it's one of those stories where you put in your nursing journal that this happened this year at this time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's definitely an experience. And to your point, you know, it's interesting. We had the same kind of thing with a lot of organizations with the COVID-19 is, you know, when setting up the testing operations, unless people had that particular either training or experience with either particular hazmat or contamination control, or whether they have been in the military or law enforcement or fire protection or whatnot. There were a lot of people that were having to learn how to do contamination control and, you know, hot zone, warm zone, cold zone, disinfection, decontamination, donning, doffing. They were having to learn all that very quickly. So it is definitely an experience a lot of people will certainly never forget. But yeah, it's with the hospital hazmat, you know, you've got the patient decontamination if they come in on life flight or you know, air ambulance or medevac or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, there's a lot of things that go on there with the, you know, you've got the powered air purifying respirator, and you've got the Tyvek suit and the whole thing. So yeah, you're definitely correct. It's, unless you've done it, it's hard to explain.
Yeah. For sure. I can definitely tell you it's very different on the inpatient side, being in a hot zone, than on the public health side. And so I was still learning, working with you on the public health side and seeing how we did it. Thankfully, you know, the language was there, so I didn't have the language barrier, because it is speaking a different language. But it's still very eye-opening to go through it when you do it in a different setting. And so I don't want to take that away from anyone who is experiencing it for the first time and feeling a little vulnerable. I think it's good to know that that's okay.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, it's interesting thing. You know, we used to, as a matter of fact, I gave a presentation just a couple of days ago, and that was part of what I said was, you know, the same things that, for example, when I was in the Air Force, the same things that we spent months learning and training and exercising, you know, there were a lot of people that had to learn that in a matter of minutes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, to your point, you know, it's definitely not a diss on anybody if they've never seen that before, if they were able to pick it up and do it with a real virus, you know, severe respiratory acute syndrome. That's legit. You know, that's hard work. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But speaking of that, so we've been talking about, you know, of course, a myriad of different potential disease exposures and all these different factors. So as you know, within the healthcare environment, you know, you've got, especially in the hospital setting, I should say, you know, of course, you've got your nursing leaders. And then you've got, in the hospital environment, they tend to call what I do, for example, they tend to call us employee safety. And then you've got your patient safety, and you've got your infection prevention and control. You know, it's kind of stratified among several different departments, in at least in the hospital setting. Do you feel like there's a lot of good opportunities there for those different areas to partner together for the, you know, for the common purpose?
Oh, absolutely. I think if we don't partner together, it's to the detriment of the organization. Unsafe practices lead to needle stick injuries. It leads to bloodborne pathogen exposures. It leads to medication errors. It leads to nosocomial infections in the clinic. It leads to things that are all preventable. It leads to employee infections, an individual that shows up to work with certain symptoms that they don't realize are actually symptoms of a communicable disease. So I think we should always actualize and implement worker safety from the beginning of orientation when you start an organization. That way you know that it's a priority, and that it's everyone's responsibility. And we want to make sure that it's okay to hold one another accountable, and that peer-to-peer accountability is what makes it work as well, not the supervisor holding the employee accountable, but us holding one another accountable to say it's okay to prioritize safety.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I totally agree. It's, I think that's one of the big factors about the pandemic, especially that whereas in the past there may have been at times there may have been some confusion about, okay, well, where does employee safety start and stop, and where does patient safety start and stop? And you know, at this point, if they're not correlated, then there's going to be a gap. So I definitely agree, is, you know, not only should that all be a collaborative effort, but it should start at the very beginning. So everybody understands that, you know, if you don't take care of yourself as a worker, then that could create not only patient safety issues such as patient falls or whatnot, but then you've also got, if you don't use PPE, you know, you can get an infection just the same as you can transmit an infection. That's of course, that's happened historically with things like MRSA and whatnot. So huge amount of variables. It's been great perspective. So that, in that same regard, you know, within healthcare, of course, not only is there OSHA and, you know, of course, CDC, NIOSH, but there's also a huge role for voluntary accreditation, like Joint Commission. What are your thoughts about the role of Joint Commission or of course, I'll say their competitors, you know, in safety within healthcare?
I've always welcomed working in the inpatient setting. I've always welcomed Joint Commission here at the Houston Health Department, welcoming OSHA standards, CLIA, any other governmental agency audits, and any entities to provide standards. And I utilize their recommendations just as baseline guidance, because I think those baseline guidance are just what they are, standards of care. And what I try to impart upon the team is that we don't want to meet these expectations. Our goal is to exceed these expectations. So with these being baseline guidance, let's see what we can do to go a step further than what this guideline is. That way we know that we're not only in compliance, we can actually exceed the mark of the compliance that's been given here. And oftentimes we've actually set the bar even higher for other organizations. So where they're saying, hey, this is what Houston is doing. Did you guys know that? And so we've been the leaders in innovation for some of the standards of care. And I'm very proud of working for an organization that's done that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's fantastic. And I totally agree with that, you know, being able to find the most effective means, you know, even if it goes well beyond the standard, you know, that's not a thing that's, it's not in effect, it's not inefficiency, it's not excess, it's just getting better, you know, continual improvement, and that can always be justified. Yeah, and I totally agree. Like what you were saying there is some of the proudest moments I've had, you know, in the last, what, almost 17 and a half years is, we with National Safety Council and some of the other organizations that we work with, and AOHP, many times AOHP for sure. We've spoken with colleagues in other cities and other areas, and we've been able to provide them with either our plans or our different resources and templates and checklists, and they've been able to use those. And not only does it help them, you know, save I guess time, but we're able to, you know, combine efforts, and if we know that what we're doing is able to help somebody stay safe and, you know, across the United States, that's a pretty huge thing, I think. So I totally agree with that.
For sure. I agree.
Yeah. So this last thing I was going to ask you, this is kind of the million dollar question I always ask. And one day I'm going to, full disclosure, one day I'm going to write an article and I'm going to use this as research. You know, each time we do a different subject matter expert interview, I take this question and I jot down the answer. And one day I'm going to do an article and I'll fully credit you. So if you had the magic wand, you know, if you could change anything you want about whether it's safety or whether it's healthcare in general or nursing, what would you want to wave your magic wand and change?
Oh, wow. Well, I hope my answer writes in your future journal article. But I think healthcare safety is actually life skills safety. And so I think it should really start at an early age. And I think, you know, at an early age, we begin to develop our conscious mind and our moral fabric. And with my magic wand, I think I would start these conversations in life early and more often so that healthcare safety is a part of something that's the standard and that's expected. And so all individuals know that it's something as simple as the manners that you learn. It's one of those things where they say everything you needed to learn in life you learned in kindergarten. It should be a part of that conversation too. It's something that you should have learned in kindergarten. One of those healthcare safety pieces. It should have started there. It should have started there, not to put the box too high on the shelf. It should have started there, you know, about the hand hygiene. It should have started there about coughing into the elbow. And when we touch on frequently, you know, touch surfaces and disinfection versus, you know, actually cleaning something. Some of those conversations start a little earlier. That way, it's not something to where we have to actively do. It's almost something that's involuntary. So safety becomes something that's more just a thing that you do and not something that you do intentionally. It's something that you do because it's a rudimentary behavior. And it's a moray, it's a norm.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and I totally agree with that. You know, if we can get to that point where it's not a matter of, you know, well, should I take the time for the safety protocol, or, you know, it should just be unheard of to not follow the safety protocol. That would be just something that people just never thought, like it would never cross their mind to not follow the safety protocol, because like you said, you know, it opens the door for potential, whether it's cross contamination or whether it's an injury, all different things that, you know, there's just no reason to take that risk. Great perspective. But we sure appreciate your time today. Is there before we wrap up, anything else you'd like to bring up today?
I think we've covered it all. I just want to say how appreciative and humbled I am to be a guest on your podcast. I am so honored, and I respect the great work that you're doing, Corey, and I just want you to know that I am truly, truly, truly amazed by the work that you've done here at the health department, and I just want to give you your kudos for everything that you're doing as well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. It's, you know, honestly, I'm just, you know, I'm happy every day that I'm allowed to do this, you know, because I kind of look at it like I don't take it for granted that this is just
my job. You know, I kind of feel like, you know, we have an obligation to do our best, you know, and that can certainly be taken away. So I want to make sure that I'm doing right by everybody. And, I appreciate you saying that, 'cause that kind of gives me a good sense of validation that, you know, we haven't let you or your team down, at least not too much.
Never.
Well, thank you. But yeah, we sure appreciate you being here. You're certainly fantastic. You're a subject matter expert, great deal of experience and expertise. So, it's always great to hear from you and always a joy talking to you.
All right. Well, we sure appreciate Tracy being with us and giving us her great expertise and perspectives and experiences. So as always, definitely check out our podcasts. We're on anchor.fm/ASSP-HCPS-HealthBeat. And it's got all of our episodes on there, including our recent 6-part series where we're talking to other practice specialties about how their industries and best practices relate to healthcare. So with that being said, we hope to hear from everybody real soon. Check us out on LinkedIn, check us out on Twitter, and of course, check us out on ASSP, and we'll talk to you real soon. Everybody have a great day. Thank you for joining us.